KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I don't want to fight either. I'm not looking to fight. But if it's a choice between fighting and them having a nuclear weapon, you have to do what you have to do.
So says President Trump, but some of his MAGA allies disagree with the president on how far to go in Iran. Today is Thursday, June 19th, and this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ahead this hour, Iranian Americans are watching events in the Middle East closely. We'll hear from L.A., home to the largest Iranian community outside Iran.
People are so desperate for the downfall of the regime, which we are too. I am too. But I can't sit and watch Tehran being bombed.
Plus, the FAA needs more air traffic controllers. Why are they so hard to hire? And if you want to make it in girls softball in Brooklyn, you better know how to chant.
It just motivates and gives them confidence in themselves.
So that they can, feel better in the field and, when they're batting.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Calls for the assassination of Iran's supreme leader are growing in Israel. Speaking to reporters today, Israel's defense minister compared Ayatollah Ali Khamenei to Hitler, reiterating it was time for Iran's supreme leader to go. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports.
Speaking to reporters in Holon, the worst-hit suburb of Tel Aviv Thursday, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said that killing Iran's supreme leader is a goal of the war. The Israeli military was directed and knows that in order to achieve all the objectives of the war, this man certainly cannot continue to exist, he said. Earlier this week, Katz said, quote, "We will strike the Iranian dictator everywhere." That came after the Israeli military struck an Iranian state TV studio. About the supreme leader, President Trump posted this week on his social media platform, Truth Social, quote, "We know exactly where he is," but added, quote, "We are not going to take him out, kill, at least for now." Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
U.S. embassies will resume offering appointments for international students applying for visas amid new guidelines for screening applicants' social media accounts. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Secretary Rubio has taken a tough line on student visas, revoking some visas from international students who took part in protests against Israel's war in Gaza. Now he's instructing consular officials to look through the social media accounts of all student visa applicants for any indications of, quote, hostility toward the citizens, culture, government, institutions, or founding principles of the United States. International students are also being vetted for perceived anti-Semitism. Applicants will be asked to set their social media accounts to public so that consular officials can look at them before issuing a visa. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
In Colorado, a federal judge says hate crime charges can proceed against a man who allegedly threw Molotov cocktails at a crowd in Boulder. Colorado Public Radio's Allison Sherry has more.
There was a lengthy debate in federal court about whether Mohammed Soleiman targeted the group that gathered regularly to call for the release of Israeli hostages because of their national origin. His attorney argued that he didn't care about where the actual protesters were from, but that he disagreed with their political beliefs, which isn't covered under federal hate crimes law. Federal prosecutors say in the man's writings and interviews with police, he was targeting Zionists, which is support for the nation-state of Israel, and that there is enough probable cause to proceed on the hate crimes piece of his charges. The judge ultimately agreed with the prosecutors. For NPR News, I'm Allison Sherry in Denver.
U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. You're listening to NPR News. North Korea fired several rounds of rocket artillery westward into the sea. This a day after South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. held joint air drills for the first time under a new South Korean president. The South's military says the North fired about 10 rounds from multiple rocket launchers near Pyongyang. Ukrainian and Western intelligence say the North provided these weapons to Russia for use against Ukraine. South Korea is calling on Moscow and Pyongyang to halt what they call an illegal cooperation. Hurricane Eric made landfall in the Mexican state of Oaxaca as a Category 3 storm this morning. It's now been downgraded to a tropical storm and is expected to dissipate overnight. And Pierre Zeta Peralta is in nearby Honduras. He says authorities are still surveying the damage.
Hurricane Eric came on shore in Mexico's Pacific coast early Thursday morning, just north of Puerto Escondido in Oaxaca. Authorities said landslides had closed roads and brought down power lines across the region. Hurricanes this strong are not common in that part of Mexico, though in 2023, Hurricane Otis devastated Acapulco. It intensified into a Category 5 in a matter of hours, giving little time for evacuations. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said this time it was different.
Afortunadamente y agradecer a la población.
Fortunately, we have to thank the people for heeding evacuation orders, she said. Ada Peralta, NPR News, San Pedro Sula, Honduras.
Asian markets are trading in mixed territory at this hour. The Nikkei in Japan up about 0.3%. The Asia Dow down about 0.3%. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump campaigned on ending long foreign wars. In his inauguration speech earlier this year, Trump said his proudest legacy would be that of peacemaker.
We will measure our success not only by the battles we win, but also by the wars that we end, and perhaps most importantly, the wars we never get into.
Well, now some of his most vocal supporters warn that Trump risks betraying those promises if the U.S. joins Israel in its battle with Iran. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is covering the divide inside MAGA. He joins me now from the White House. Hey, Franco.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So I want to note that the White House said today Trump is pushing any action on Iran back, that he will decide within the next 2 weeks. That, however, has not dispelled criticism of potential U.S. involvement. Who are these MAGA figures turned critics? What are they saying?
Yeah, I mean, two of the big names are Tucker Carlson, the former talk show host, and Steve Bannon, who served as White House chief strategist at the beginning of the first Trump administration. Carlson actually explained his position this week on Bannon's podcast, The War Room.
My interest is really simple. I don't want the United States enmeshed in another Middle Eastern war that doesn't serve our interests.
Carlson also warned that the president's legacy was on the line, depending on what happens next. And then there's Bannon, who calls himself one of the biggest names in MAGA, and he really is, who also spoke in very dramatic fashion. Here he is at a breakfast yesterday hosted by the Christian Science Monitor.
We can't do this again. We'll tear the country apart. We can't have another Iraq.
So strong cautions there from two strong supporters of Trump. How is the president responding?
Yeah, I mean, he's been very defensive about these comments, especially from Carlson. At the G7, Trump actually belittled Carlson for losing his TV show on Fox News, and then he referred to him as kooky Tucker Carlson. But he was actually more thoughtful when pressed about concerns about the U.S. being drawn into another long fight.
Well, I don't want to fight either. I'm not looking to fight. But if it's a choice between fighting and them having a nuclear weapon, you have to do what you have to do. Maybe we won't have to fight. Don't forget, we haven't been fighting.
You know, in announcing that two-week delay, the White House says Trump is following his own instincts and that Carlson and Bannon's position did not play a role. And I should also note that not everyone in MAGA world opposes U.S. involvement. Mm-hmm. Folks like Fox News, Mark Levin have enthusiastically called for Trump to help Israel in the war. And so have folks like Senator Lindsey Graham, who has traditionally taken a more hawkish stance on foreign policy.
Speaking of more hawkish stances, Franco, All this talk about striking Iran, I mean, you can hear the echoes of hawkish Republican positions of the past. Is Trump aligning himself with mainstream Republicans?
I mean, you really can hear those echoes. And that is actually some of what I'm hearing from mainstream Republicans who I speak with. Ryan Williams is a Republican strategist who I spoke with. He helped lead Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. And he pointed out that regime change in Iran has been a longtime goal for several Republican administrations.
I think a number of people in the Bush administration who at the time thought of ways to address this issue, either with the military or other means, would be surprised today to find that the then host of the Celebrity Apprentice is the one that could potentially take out the Ayatollah.
All right. Some thoughts there from Ryan Williams in our reporting from Franco Ordonez at the White House. Thanks, Franco.
Thank you.
Buried in the Trump administration's proposed 2026 budget is the near elimination of the Ecosystems Mission Area. That is a program that monitors living things and the health of the land and water that they inhabit. NPR's Ari Daniel reports that career scientists are deeply concerned about the potential cut.
Sam Drogi rummages around his trunk, filled with buckets, boots, and vials, before heading into a park on the edge of Washington, D.C., atop what was once a landfill.
I have a net. Yes, we're going to catch bees.
Not honeybees, but all manner of other bees.
There's no stinging, there's no allergic reactions.
We stop at a blackberry patch. Its flowers sway in the breeze.
I don't know if you can even see that bee in there, but...
Where is it?
It's in there.
That little guy?
Yeah.
Wow.
Half the size of a grain of rice. But most bees are super small.
And yet, these teensy insects play an outsized role in pollinating all sorts of plants, including ones we grow and eat.
And so, those little bees, they're running the world.
Drogi is with the U.S. Geological Survey, where he heads up the Bee Lab, an outfit that supports researchers at other government agencies and universities who study native bees, by helping states, for example, identify which bees are rare and in need of protection.
We're here to advise and help people understand what kind of bees are around, how they're doing, what their status is.
Drogi's work at the USGS is part of the Ecosystems Mission Area, a group that helps the federal government manage and conserve wildlife and the natural environment nationwide.
There's people who are working on monitoring bats, monitoring birds.
There are teams who monitor fisheries, environmental contaminants, and wildlife diseases.
So we work on problems that impact the nation as a whole. Someone needs to be looking at the bigger picture than what states and academics can often do.
And it's this program, the Ecosystems Mission Area, or EMA, that the proposed 2026 federal budget is slashing by 90%. Drogi speculates it may be because EMA research into different species can inform regulations that limit the use of land and natural resources.
If you don't know anything, you don't have a problem. So having this kind of information is really inconvenient to business.
NPR reached out to the Office of Management and Budget to confirm the planned cut. In an email, a spokesperson replied the EMA is, quote, obviously irrelevant to science and is exactly the kind of waste President Trump ran on rooting out of the federal government. Jill Barron disagrees. She's an ecosystem ecologist at Colorado State University, and in the mid-90s, while in government, she helped create the EMA.
We suggested that this would be a more appropriate way to tackle grand societal questions than what we'd had before.
Barron points to her own 43-year research study of the Rocky Mountain National Park watershed. Early on, she and her colleagues were looking for evidence of acid rain. Instead, they found excess nitrogen coming from air pollution, which the federal and state governments then stepped in to reduce. And more recently, she's detected climate change impacts.
If you stop long-term monitoring, you not only can't see if the changes are getting worse, you can't see if the actions actually made a difference.
In addition, the EMA helps protect Americans from natural disasters like flooding, landslides, hurricanes, and fire.
So if you lose EMA, it really fundamentally changes our ability to understand and respond appropriately to these challenges that seem to be expanding every day.
Paul Stebline was the Wildland Fire Science Coordinator under the EMA until he retired late last year.
Cutting a few million dollars is going to have billions of dollars of impact. It's going to affect people's lives. It's going to affect their health. I think it's short-sighted.
Back in the park in Washington, D.C., Sam Drogi, with a flick of the wrist, whips his net through the blackberry flowers.
See, there's that little bee right there. And I have to be fast because bees are really fast.
He'll bring the bees he snags back to the lab to ID them, and then they'll join a collection of some 800,000 bees that the EMA and the researchers they partnered with have amassed over the decades.
This is our life. Like, I would do this without being paid, which I very well may.
Drogi says that he and his colleagues are now racing to make sure that vast bee library of theirs is safe in case their work is suddenly shuttered. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
If you've watched the NBA over the past 50 years, this might sound familiar.
There it is. It's over, and the most valuable player is Magic Johnson. He starts at center, plays forward and guard, and leads the Los Angeles Lakers to a world championship.
The LA Lakers, the 2010 NBA champions.
And that's it. It's over. This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers.
The Los Angeles Lakers, one of the league's most storied franchises, announced this week that a controlling stake in the team will be sold for $10 billion. It's the richest deal in sports history. Jerry Buss bought the team for $67 million back in 1979. Bargain. Buss became known for his eccentric leadership style. He's famous for building what many have dubbed the Showtime Lakers.
The Lakers meant everything to him. If the team didn't play well, it was a personal failure for him.
That is Jeff Perlman, sports writer and author of the book Showtime, Magic, Kareem, Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers Dynasty of the 1980s.
When Jerry Buss bought the Lakers in 1979, he wanted to be the owner of the Lakers. Like, yeah, it was an investment, and yeah, he wanted to make money, but more than anything, he wanted to own a basketball team, and he wanted to own the Lakers, and he saw that as his identity.
Jerry's daughter, Jeannie Buss, took over the team in 2013 after her father died. Here she is talking to NPR's A. Martinez earlier this year.
Dad explained it to me very well. He put me ultimately in charge.
Right.
He told me, Jeannie, you have the hammer, and I expect you to use it.
Mark Walter, whose firm Guggenheim Partners also owns the LA Dodgers, will now have a controlling stake in the team. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The U.S. air traffic control system is chronically understaffed. The Federal Aviation Administration has tried for years to build up the ranks, but it's still thousands of controllers short of its hiring goals. NPR's Joel Rose reports on why it's so hard to train enough air traffic controllers.
The movie Pushing Tin is mostly forgotten, except as the answer to a trivia question about Angelina Jolie and Billy Bob Thornton, who met on the set. But air traffic controllers tend to remember it, because it's a workplace drama about the people who managed the airspace around New York City in the 90s.
American 7736, contact Newark Tower 118.3, take care, thanks.
You do good work. American 7736.
Is that Chris Rectorum or what?
I got him lined up like rockets.
I was actually there when they made the movie.
Michael McCormick worked in air traffic control for over 30 years, including a stint at the New York Radar Approach Control in the 90s. Now he's the head of the air traffic management program at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida, where he's training the next generation of controllers on how to do the job.
In your head, you create a mental model of what is actually transpiring on your displays. And with that mental model, you can then look to the future and predict where the aircraft are going to be based upon the current conditions. You will be able to then project, this aircraft I need to turn, this aircraft I need to climb, this aircraft I need to descend.
It's not a job for everyone. You have to have the innate ability, as well as the determination to push through years of training, to learn the nuances of each aircraft, each airport, and each control facility. The first big hurdle is an aptitude test, known as the Air Traffic Skills Assessment, or ATSA.
I'm not an anxious person, typically, but that test scared me.
Jack Cairns is studying air traffic management at Embry-Riddle. The test focuses on spatial reasoning, short-term memory, and math, and it is intense, partly because of the material itself, and partly, Cairns says, because the stakes are so high.
That's why it stresses you out so much, because it could end your career before it started.
There are only three scores you can get on the ATSA: not referred, qualified, and well qualified. The FAA does not say much about how the test works, but in practice, you need a score of well qualified in order to get hired. Some applicants get that on their first try, like Alejandro Jaramillo, who recently graduated from Embry-Riddle.
I know people who have taken it five or six times before they got a good enough score. And I know some people who are like me who...
cheered for no matter what.
Weiss says that's nice, especially for preteens who can be cliquey. And chants are a huge part of that team spirit. A few innings later, the sun is out, it's hot, and you can almost smell the sunscreen. The Renegades have fallen behind. But as she walks off the field into the dugout, catcher Maeve Clark-Howe is still optimistic.
So guys, what's the score?
2-15.
And you think you can come back?
I think we can get close, yeah.
On the other side of the diamond, the Devils are also chanting.
Is she high? Is she low? Is she fast? Is she slow? Is she in? Is she out? Is she all about? We don't care. We don't care. We can hit it anywhere. Watch the pitcher. Watch, watch the pitcher. Watch the pitcher. Watch how she pitches.
One final devilish pitch, and the game is over. Final score, Renegades 2, Devils 17. As they say here in Brooklyn, wait till next year. In the meantime, the Renegades have a proven method for keeping their spirits up.
S-U-P-R, we're Supergirls, that's what we are, we're Supergirls, why can't you see we're number one, not two, not three?
For NPR News, I'm Sally Herships in Brooklyn.
Love it. Go girls. It's NPR News.
The U.S. has a shortage of air traffic controllers. Training can take years. Then there's medical and background checks. Some schools are trying to change that.
Now we can start that process early in their academic career. They can then be directly hired to an air traffic control facility.
We learn about accelerated air traffic control training programs tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
All things considered, from NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This Juneteenth, we'll visit a new exhibit in Harpersville, Alabama, that explores the lives of Black families there after emancipation.
What's interesting is people expressing an interest in learning about their own ancestry and how their ancestry intersects with other people's ancestry.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Trump is weighing whether or not the U.S. will enter the war between Israel and Iran. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says he will make the decision within the next 2 weeks. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
The most fortified nuclear facility in Iran is called Fordo, located deep inside a mountain. And the U.S. has the only bomb that could damage it. Because of its size, that 30,000-pound bomb can only be carried by a B-2 stealth bomber, also something only the U.S. has. Most experts agree that the bomb could cause serious, possibly even debilitating damage to the facility, although it could take several hits. The real question is whether that would stop Iran's nuclear program or simply put it on hold, as Iran would still have the scientists and knowledge to start it back up again. Meanwhile, the International Atomic Energy Agency has warned such an attack could cause radioactive contamination. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
Despite President Trump's indication last week that he would pull back on immigration raids on farms, ranches, hotels, and restaurants, nothing has changed. And as of today, ICE agents have resumed the raids. Border Czar Tom Homan told reporters,
I've been saying for years Congress needs to address this. But because Congress failed to address it doesn't mean we ignore it. I mean, it's illegal to knowingly hire an illegal alien.
Customs and Border Protection agents arrived at Dodgers Stadium in Los Angeles today and were asked by the baseball organization to leave the grounds. They'd arrived at a parking lot near one of the gates. The team says the agents requested permission to access the stadium's parking lot but were denied entry and asked to leave. For a third time, President Trump has signed an executive order to keep TikTok running in the U.S. for another 90 days. President Trump hopes to broker a deal to bring the social media platform under American ownership. This is NPR News in Washington. This year, Juneteenth marks the 160th anniversary of the end of slavery in America. On this occasion, Lon Gonzalez from member station KEDT in Corpus Christi tells us there was a little-known Underground Railroad connection to Texas.
Escaped slaves used the Underground Railroad to head north to freedom, but very few know that same Underground Railroad had a path through South Texas.
It is becoming more widely known that people who were self-emancipating and seeking freedom from being enslaved were not only traveling north, but they were traveling south through Texas and across the Rio Grande to achieve freedom in Mexico.
That's Roseanne Bacha Garza, anthropology lecturer and history professor at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley. She adds there's no definitive number of escaped slaves that made their way to Mexico, with estimates in the thousands. I'm Lon Gonzalez in Corpus Christi.
How much does a pro football cheerleader make per game? The Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders at least just got a big pay raise after pushing for a raise for years. In 2019, the cheerleaders got a raise to $400 per game. Now in the second season of the Netflix series, America's Sweethearts, Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, a member of the team said they were about to get a 400% pay raise. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell, streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Los Angeles is home to the largest Iranian community outside of Iran. As reporter Benjamin Gottlieb tells us, how folks there feel about the escalating conflict between Israel and Iran has a lot to do with who they are and how they came to live in the U.S.
Tara Grammy is glued to her phone.
Do you mind if I turn on the news?
We're about to sit down for lunch at Atari Sandwich Shop in Westwood. It's a destination here for L.A. Persian fare. Favorites like Persian potato salad with chicken or beef tongue served on crunchy French bread. Grammy is an actor, producer, and playwright. She's just finished an audition for a new role, but she can't think about all that right now. Like most Iranians living in the diaspora, her mind is fixated on what's happening inside Iran and the well-being of her family members that still live there.
People are so desperate for the downfall of the regime, which we are too. I am too. But I can't sit and watch Tehran being bombed.
Grammy was born in Tehran and immigrated to Toronto when she was 6 years old. But she'd spend just about every summer in Iran with her family. She says she's no stranger to threats of war.
But when it's your own country and your own people and streets that you recognize and the names, and that's where my aunt lives, that's where my uncle lives, that's where we went shopping, it's like, it's just a constant stream of shocked and terrified.
That combination of shock and terror permeates much of LA's Persian diaspora, the largest community outside of Iran. But so too does staunch criticism of the current Iranian government.
I want the people of Iran to be free from the Islamic Republic. I want my family and friends and the people of Iran to be safe.
Nazanin Noor is also an actor who's become well known in recent years for her anti-regime activism. Like Grammy, she's fearful of traveling to Iran, where she used to visit as a child, because of her past criticism of the Iranian regime, most recently during the Women Life Freedom protests a few years ago. She has complex feelings about what's happening, especially Israel's ability to spur the sort of political change that she's desperate for.
You can be anti-Islamic Republic and also anti-foreign intervention, and also from a regime specifically that's committing their own atrocities against another people, the Palestinians. How do we think that they're going to have any hand in actually freeing, quote-unquote, liberating, quote-unquote, another people?
The view, however, is a bit different for many Iranian religious and ethnic minorities living abroad, Baha'is, Christians, and Jews, who've been persecuted by the regime.
No Iranian-American wants to see Iranians stuck in the middle of a war, but nothing can be worse than what this regime is and what it has done.
Sam Yebri was born in Tehran, but he fled when he was just a year old with his family amid the Iranian Revolution. He's Jewish, and like the vast majority of Iranian Jews living in the diaspora, he hasn't been back since.
That's one of the hopes, is that Iranians of all backgrounds across the globe, Muslims, Christians, Baha'is, Zoroastrians, Jews, can one day return to the land of our birth.
Yebri believes, like many Persian Jews, that Israel's military campaign in Iran is the best chance in recent memory of fomenting regime change. But for folks like Grammy, folks who have traveled extensively to Iran and still have family there, how change happens matters.
Do you know what I named my son? My son's name is Diyar, which means homeland, and his last name is Azad, which means free.
Free homeland. Her biggest dream, she says, is to take her son, not yet 2 years old, to visit Iran. And while she's not supportive of her hometown being bombed, she knows taking him just isn't possible without political change. For NPR News, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb in Los Angeles.
A couple of tax measures in President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act are causing consternation in the business community. Those tax measures have already passed the House. Now they're in the hands of the Senate. Our colleagues at The Indicator, Darian Woods and Adrian Ma, explain.
Since the Reagan administration, the U.S. has encouraged global money to flow freely. But two sections tucked away in the big spending bill going through Congress could disrupt that. A tax on money immigrants send to their home countries. And another measure that's been called a revenge tax. Let's start with the tax on immigrants sending money overseas, commonly known as remittances. It would be a 3.5% tax.
Now, would that apply to people on visas or green cards? That's unknown at this stage. Reuven Aviona is a tax law professor at the University of Michigan.
This is a totally new form of tax that the United States has not tried before. And so there's a lot of details that are not clear.
So is a tax on remittances good for American citizens? Reuven says that's hard to answer. The increased revenue for the U.S. government will be a plus, but he thinks the whole intent is actually to discourage immigration in the first place. And if that happened, that would reduce the amount of revenue that could be raised from remittances. If immigration decreased, America would also lose out on that labor, the skills, and the talent those people bring. Now, turning to the second big policy in the big, beautiful spending bill is the so-called revenge tax, which applies to certain foreign countries. Essentially, it means the U.S. government would add new taxes on American dividends and profits, rents and royalties, and some interest of these foreign investors.
Yeah, so let's explain this with an example. Say I run a Canadian restaurant chain.
Poutine Delight?
That's a good name. So I have some Poutine Delight restaurants in the U.S., and this revenge tax would mean I have to pay an additional tax on the profits I get from selling to my U.S. customers.
Which countries these actually are would be decided by the Treasury Secretary. See, they would determine if other countries' governments have been taxing U.S. companies unfairly. In international tax parlance, this is called discrimination.
Discrimination in the tax context means that you're treating corporations from one country worse than your own corporations or worse than corporations from different countries.
One example is the digital services taxes that countries like France and Canada are putting on platforms like Facebook and Google.
Reuven sees problems with the U.S. fighting back, though.
I was just in Canada, The Canadians love their digital services tax.
And critics here are also concerned that it could impede foreign investment. There is a potential way that overseas companies could invest in the US while avoiding the extra tax. Reuven Aviona sees the so-called revenge tax as losing a lot of its bite when a company from, say, Canada again, could simply start a new subsidiary in the US.
Poutine delight, USA.
Precisely. Different paperwork, American in name only, but they might avoid the tax. There is one big exception, though. Banks, which can't do that.
We called and emailed Jason Smith, the Republican chair of the House Ways and Means Committee who helped draft the bill. He didn't get back to us by our deadline, but at a recent panel, he described the measure as a way to deter other countries from taxing U.S. companies unfairly.
So that they understand that if they do that to U.S. businesses, there will be consequences for their actions. Hopefully it'll never take an effect.
Hopefully it'll never take effect. So it sounds like Jason Smith understands that if these measures are implemented, they could be economically disruptive. Darian Woods,
Adrian Ma, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says seed oils, things like soybean, corn, and sunflower oils, that they are poisoning Americans. Most of the medical community rejects that. But the messaging from the White House and its allies is causing real headaches for farmers who grow the crops. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
The oil from pressing corn, canola, soy, and other plant seeds used to be known simply as vegetable oil. Now it's widely called seed oil, and RFK Jr. says the stuff triggers chronic inflammation. His Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA movement, recently released a documentary slamming seed oil, along with fluoride and farm chemicals. Here's Catherine Shanahan, who calls herself Dr. Kate, on the video.
The source of the most toxins is seed oils. They are worse than glyphosate, herbicides, pesticides combined. When you've been eating seed oils, your cells can't get energy out of it efficiently. And that's what causes heart attacks and strokes.
The American Heart Association, the Mayo Clinic, and many other health advocates disagree. They point to decades of studies that show that seed oils reduce bad cholesterol and help stave off heart attacks and strokes. However, seed oils are used in deep fried foods and high calorie processed snacks, typically full of salt and sugar. That stuff is unhealthy, and seed oils may suffer a kind of guilt by association.
I have made a big drastic switch in my personal life. I've decided to just not use them.
Philip Stegner is general manager at Billy's Grocery, an upscale bakery and cafe in Kansas City.
We've had a lot of people come in here and be like, are you guys totally seed oil free? And I'm like, no, but we have a very big emphasis on using healthy fats.
Even burger chain Steak and Shake is switching to butter and sauces and now sells bacon double cheeseburgers with fries that are cooked in beef fat or tallow, not seed oil. The disputed claims about soy, corn, and sunflower oil have reached all the way to the sunflower farm that Cameron Pierce operates in central Kansas.
I mean, my own kids, my son just walked through here, and I'll use him as an example. He goes, 3 months ago, he said, seed oils are bad for you. And I'm like, well, scientifically, they're not. He's getting it from social media.
Pierce says those TikTok posts are a real threat to the business. Farmer Tim Michelson feels the same. He grows canola, another seed oil crop in North Dakota, and says losing money over innuendo is galling to farmers who work all day, every day in the realm of empirical reality.
Everything we do revolves around science. So the MAHA movement, it's kind of been frustrating for me to watch because those decisions are based off of fear, speculation, and information that is not backed by science.
Michelson says he believes the movement has so far cut canola sales by maybe 5%. He's surprised that the anti-seed oil trend has taken hold, worries where it'll lead. Farm lobbyists say they're engaged and hope to protect farmers who grow seed oil crops. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
is a strong force in the town, even though it's a small town. And like you said, one of the reddest counties in the country.
Yeah.
And then the third family, we don't know who they are, but we have these wonderful photos of them that were captured on something called Tintypes. And Tintypes were the photograph of the day. And if you are able to visit the Wallace Center's newest exhibit, then you'll be able to see the photos of these newly emancipated people dressed in their finest clothing as they take these pictures and they look ready to take on a new life, a new world. You can see the determination in their faces. You can see the hope in their faces. You can see that they're ready and poised to move forward. And so those are the three families that we honor.
And people listening will have picked up on, you're talking about these families who lived at the Wallace Plantation, who worked the Wallace land. You're now the executive director of the Wallace Center for Arts and Reconciliation. This is telling the history of what happened on that same ground.
Yeah, that's right. So the Wallace Center is a descendant-led organization. And what that means is that the descendants of the people who were enslaved on that land or either worked that land as sharecroppers came together with the white descendants of the slaveholders to preserve the history of what happened at the Wallace Center, as well as to foster discussions about racial reconciliation to make a better and more equitable future. And so what is distinctive about the Wallace Center is that we are on 6 acres of what used to be the Wallace Plantation.
Uh-huh.
Originally, the plantation was over 5,000 acres. So we recognize the horrors that happened on that land and in that house. While we have preserved the house, it's not with the purpose of allowing people to tour it to sort of look at grandeur. It's to capture a time in history that demonstrates the resilience and survival of a people whose ancestry exists to this day.
So tell me what people coming to see this specific exhibit will see, will experience, to try to capture something that is now unimaginable, that experience of a sharecropper on a plantation in the South.
You know, when you think about emancipation, and when you think about it just like strictly from the viewpoint of what we learn in schools, if we learn about it in schools, it's, you know, the slaves were freed. Well, the reality is that these were people who had been living in captivity, who once emancipation started, had a whole world of things to consider and deal with that they had not before, right? So there's the question of, where am I gonna work? Am I going to work somewhere different than being on this plantation? If I am on this plantation still, is it going to be much different than what it was before? There are questions about education, about how to get education, about how to form kinship groups, about how to establish churches and institutions. And then there are these very basic questions about having agency over yourself, having autonomy over yourself, right? That they would have been faced with. So if you come to this exhibit, we invite you to step into the shoes of these people who are living on the precipice of a change in history that none of them had been able to fathom until that very time. And we invite you to pick up and touch objects that they would have used. Things as simple as water jugs, hay picks, land deeds, and to just imagine what their lives would have been like and to experience it through their viewpoint.
Yeah. I noted that y'all are in Harpersville, which is a predominantly white town in a red county in Alabama. How has the exhibit been received by locals so far?
So while Harpersville is mostly white, there is a strong Black presence in the community, particularly from Black descendants at the Wallace Center. And so, of course, we have that support. But in terms of the wider Harpersville community, I am heartened to say that we have had interest, that we have had white visitors come to the Wallace Center, see the exhibit, express interest, express a commitment to racial reconciliation. You know, what's wonderful about when people of various races, not just Black, not just white, come to the Wallace Center, What's interesting is people expressing an interest in learning about their own ancestry and how their ancestry intersects with other people's ancestry. And so just being able to look at these actual people that lived in this time and space really seems to ground people in good, productive conversations. And again, if that can happen in a small town like Harpersville, if in this community people can at least express interest, then I think it's possible anywhere.
Ebony Howard, she's executive director of the Wallace Center for Arts and Reconciliation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the exhibit in Harpersville, Alabama is Out of Whole Cloth, Marking History and Making Home. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
Treats me oh so mean. My man, he don't love me. He treats me awful mean. He's the lowest man that I've ever seen.